Hello and welcome to Creative Fire. I'm your host, Hugh Delahanty. And today I'll be talking with Martin Aylward, the author of a fascinating new book called Awake Where You Are. Martin has an interesting story. When he was a teenager growing up in England, he became obsessed with what he likes to call the miracle of being human. So at age 19, he dropped out and moved to India, where he studied meditation with masters from various traditions, including the Hindu sage, Babaji. Years later, he returned to Britain and became an innovative meditation teacher in his own right, with students all over the world. Martin's new book is probably the best book I've ever read on how to cultivate embodied awareness. So I thought it would be interesting to talk to him about the importance of the body in meditation and the creative process. Here we go. So let's go. What I want to talk to you, as I said, I'd like to kind of talk about embodied presence as it relates to creativity, and also some other topics. But I was the first question I wanted to ask you was the basic one: what is embodied presence, and why is it so important?
Yeah. So what is embodied presence? I mean, you ask me, that's the first question. But of course, that alone, we could spend a lot of time exploring that. It's kind of mysterious, right? I mean, what is presence, first of all, without the element of embodied? And for me, presence is the translation of the word sati in Pali, right? Which is usually translated, but we mostly know that as mindfulness. Right. But what we usually call mindfulness is made up of two significant bits. The first bit is presence, right? The capacity to actually be here and know that you're here. I mean, in some ways, we're always here, right? Even when we're distracted, where's our distraction happening? We might be thinking about some other moment, some other place, but that distraction is happening here in the natural, inevitable immediacy of experience, right? So when we actually consciously let ourselves really come into the natural immediacy of experience, I call that presence. So that's like the knowing that you're here. And for anybody listening to this, then we might say, well, just take a moment now to, if I say, feel your legs on the seat or your feet beneath you if you're walking or your hands on the steering wheel if you're driving, you know, you can momentarily just connect with that. But presence would be where you actually really come into something as ordinary as that, right? The fact of what's happening right now. And you train your attention to be able to soften and steady and settle in to that natural immediacy of experience. So that's what it means to be present, to know what you're knowing, to be here inside of what's here. And then why the emphasis on embodied presence? Because basically everything that's here, everything that's happening is happening within this body. This line of the Buddha's, which was the initial inspiration for the whole book I wrote, is the entire universe arises and passes right here in this body. Right. So
wow.
Within what we could say just this body, or you know, body and mind, the whole organism, the physical and emotional and energetic and conceptual, etc., everything that's going on, which we call my experience, one can get, if you don't honor the sensory part, if you don't learn to land in the physical stuff of what's happening, then your attempts to navigate your experience, meet your experience, understand your experience, transform your experience, they get derailed because mind is much more tricky than body. You know, you try to explore your mind and understand your psychology and get to know your emotional patterns, but you just so easily get derailed by all the drama that goes on there. You get derailed by the stories you tell yourself. We can convince ourselves of all kinds of complex and fantastical things. And so the foundation to not be carried away by your mind, to not believe everything you think, right, mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. to... Learn first to let your presence be here. Let it be felt. Let it be sensory. And the very first, most immediate, tangible benefit of that is that you notice, and again, anybody listening to this right now, just to enter into bodily life and notice where there are any tensions. And I bet you can find some tension somewhere, maybe in your forehead. Maybe in your jaw, maybe in your shoulders, maybe in your hands. Mm-hmm. But just to, and then to see if whatever tension you find, maybe some of it's necessary. Like if you're carrying a shopping bag right now, you know, don't relax your hand, you'll drop your bag. But the chances are that some of the tensions that we're holding are unnecessary right now and unhelpful. Mm-hmm. And, so whatever's unnecessary and unhelpful, just relax it. Mm-hmm. And relaxation is something so simple, and yet it's a very immediate, tangible benefit. It's unnecessary and unhelpful to be tense in ways that we don't need to be. Mm-hmm. And so you start to establish a ground of basic relaxation, of basic ease. And as body relaxes, mind feels more spacious, more malleable. The dramas don't get so much, they don't grab so much on us when we're not creating tension. And therefore, the inner environment of one's life becomes much more available to explore.
Hmm. One of the things I liked in your book was the distinction you made between meditative experience and sports. Because people frequently come to me and they say, oh, I don't need to meditate. I go running every day. Or I'm a musician. I get intensely focused in the experience. And that's my meditation. So tell me a little bit about that, about the distinction between the two.
Yeah. Well, firstly, it's not to be dismissive of those kinds of things. And certainly sport or artistic endeavors, right? Dance or painting or whatever it might be. One can certainly engage in those things meditatively, right? Mm-hmm. But I would distinguish it from meditation for two main reasons. The first of which is that the sense of absorption, right? Of being at one with the activity or deeply connected to what one's doing, that which is called flow often, right? In sport. Mm-hmm. It's built on intensity, right? Mm-hmm. You're running, you know, you're breathing hard, your body's full of endorphins, the muscles are going, there's a lot going on, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're dancing, you know, there's the feel and the kind of the energy and the emotional tone of the music, there's the movement of the body, etc. So that's wonderful, but meditation is quite opposite of that in terms of we're learning to steady our attention without intensity. It's much easier to be absorbed in intensity, right? If you go to the cinema and you sit there for 2 hours, your attention's very absorbed and you're just sitting for 2 hours. You don't get bored, you don't get fidgety, really. But then you sit on your ass at home on a cushion and try to meditate for 2 hours. And all of those, restlessness, boredness, doubt, hunger, go to the fridge, you know, all get a hold of you. So there's a different kind of quality that gets trained by non-intensity and training the attention just with just sitting and breathing, just sitting and sensing. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's the first big difference, is that there's no intensity. And then the second difference is the goal is very different, right? In sport, you're trying to be the fastest, the highest, the strongest, the best in some ways. You know, in artistic endeavors, well, of course, one can be engaging in an artistic sense without a clear goal of trying to get anywhere. It's more exploratory. But that's even more the case in meditation, where the goal is just to be here for the sake of meeting what's here, exploring what's here, understanding what's here. But one's not seeking any particular outcome. I mean, that may not be the case for everyone who meditates. People do meditate expecting and hoping for all kinds of outcomes. I want a special kind of experience. I want to go deep, or I want to feel peaceful, etc. Uh-huh. Actually, meditation doesn't yield very well to that kind of goal orientation. So ideally, we're putting aside all our ideas of what could happen or what should happen or what I want to happen. And we're really just making room for what is happening so as to deepen our connection with it, our understanding of it, etc.
So on the other side of this is, how does meditation or meditative experience help you become a better athlete or a better artist?
See, whether it's sport, whether it's meditation, there's some kind of sweet spot of being, having your attention be both really, really focused and steady, but also of being really relaxed and open. Mm-hmm. And those things tend for most people to be in opposite places. When we get focused, we tend to get tense. And when we get relaxed, we tend to get unfocused. Most people relax, what, by having a nap or having a few drinks or,
watching
TV, right? Various ways of spacing out. So learning to be both really, really focused, really engaged, really up close and intensely aware of what you're doing, and yet also being loose, open. And that's what's actually beautiful in art or in sport. If you watch Federer play tennis, for example, or if you watch Coltrane playing jazz, that's the quality you see. And what it looks like, what we usually call it, is it looks like freedom. That's what you see Federer play tennis. He looks so free, free in his body. Why? Because he's super focused on what's happened. Well, and he's also really at ease, really, really loose. And so that seems to be, I would say, the significant way that meditative training can enhance creativity or athleticism.
It's interesting because one of the things, reasons I got into meditation was I wanted to become a better writer. And I was thinking that I had run kind of into a creative wall where my strategy for dealing, with coming up with ideas and everything just wasn't working in the way that it had before. And I kind of longed for this sense of the kind of freedom that I had when I was a child. And ideas were just, I would flow, I would create things over here, all kinds of things. And it came very easily. And my teacher was Joko Beck, the Zen teacher. Mm-hmm. And I asked her about this, and she said that what you need to do is, well, first, be in the present as much as possible, be here and now. And the second thing was that you have to have faith that things will arise. You have to be, I think, relaxed enough and confident that something will come up. It may not be what you expected it to be, but it's something's going to come up and that you can listen to that. And it struck me that that's similar to what you were saying in your book when you said you have to have the world come to you rather than go after it. And I think in my case, I was going after it. And I learned to have it. So could you talk a little bit about that, having the world come to you?
Yeah. Well, so there's a certain kind of narrowness in when I go to the world, because what I bring to the world is all my preconceived ideas, right? So here I am sitting in this flat in Paris talking to you. And if I bring myself to the world, I already know everything. Oh, yeah, I'm in Paris in the Rue Rambuteau, and I look out the window and, oh, there's the bakery opposite and the lights are on. And what else? I can see a printer and a sofa. It's like it's all familiar. It's all, I know it all. It's like, what a dull way to connect to the world. No, I mean, it's functional if I need to go and use the printer or go across the street to the bakery, right? Uh-huh. But if we want to establish our fundamental relationship with reality, like what it is to be conscious, How come there is anything at all? How come there's a universe? How come there's the perception of a universe, right? The fact that somehow there's consciousness in which all of this is, you know, comes and goes. Then instead of bringing my, you know, going out to the world with all those preconceptions, there's this encouragement to be in a more receptive mode. We learn how to let the world come to us. Oh, the light. Right? When I let the world come to me, my familiar knowings just soften a little. And suddenly, oh, I'm aware of space and sound and movement. And everything is both simultaneously more mysterious, but more intimate, more alive, more deserving of care and attention, and somehow more nourishing. I'm nourished by the mysteriousness of things. Mm. And we're not used to that. We usually, if we first get into what we could call a kind of sacred disorientation, where we don't recognize things, we tend to freak out a little. You know, if you were in a strange place and you take a nap, maybe, and then you wake up and for a moment you don't know whether it's morning or afternoon or evening or where you are. And we tend to kind of freeze or quickly try to reassemble our more habitual sense of things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But actually, what if we didn't? Okay, I don't know where I am. What if that's not a bad thing? It's the process. We could think of meditation as a process of becoming unfamiliar, actually, with life again, so that we get to meet it again and again and again and again. We get to meet it anew. Meet it anew. I don't know if you're familiar with this way. Einstein had this practice of, actually several people throughout history. I can't remember what others now, but of taking a nap in a chair, holding on to an object, a ball, I think Einstein used, and with the idea that as he would fall asleep, he would drop the ball, and that would wake him up, because having woken up out of this, I can't remember, there's a technical medical name for that state. It only lasts about 2 minutes, and it's as we enter into sleep. And following that state, it's characterized by alpha and delta activity in the brain. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it tends to stimulate moments of shift in understanding or in thinking or in creativity. Mm-hmm. And an experiment was done where a whole bunch of students were given a maths problem to work on. And then, you know, some of them could figure it out, many not. And then they were given this take a nap with a ball in the hand experiment. And on waking from it, they would go back to the problem, and the incidence rate of people solving the problem after this experiment was huge. And interestingly enough, that's what happens in meditation, right? The ones settling down the usual thought processes. It's not the ones drifting into sleep, but ones the I think it's beta activity. I'm never very good on the technical aspect, mm-hmm. but the usual discursive blah 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 that's going on all the time. Oh, that's the bakery. That's the sofa. You know, right. Just the describing the world around us and the imagining and the being distracted and the thinking about what I'm doing and where I'm going and all that stuff. When that quietens down. In other words, when we enter into a more receptive mode of actually meeting life, mind, world, everything on its own terms, that unfamiliarity or that freshness, we could call it, somehow catalyzes new understanding, new vision, new possibility, new inspiration.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to what inspired you to go off to India and learn all this stuff when you were 19 years old.
Suffering. That would be the proper Buddhist response. Kind of existential confusion slash anxiety. Yeah, I was angsty as a teenager. I mean, not that you'd have noticed. I was pretty... I had a good, loving family situation, and I had good friendships, and I was doing okay at school. But I was just I was just shocked by the fact that I was conscious. I couldn't make sense of it. Like the miracle of being human, like just to look at my hands. What is that? What enables me to look at my hands and know it's a hand? I mean, I know that sounds ordinary, but mm-hmm. or walking along the street and thinking, if I stepped out into the traffic and a car flattened me, what would happen? I mean, conventional answer, I'd die, right? But what does that mean? What this mysterious aliveness that's in me, I get it that that would somehow stop if I was to be flattened by a car. But what does that mean? Where would it go? So these kinds of questions just started to really live in me quite intensely when I was about 17, 18. And I couldn't find anywhere to go for any answers, right? My family, the school, the village priest, you know, none of them had anything to say. And that was very disconcerting for me. The sense that why isn't anybody else interested in the miracle of being human? And the idea of going off to university and studying this or that or the other seemed way too narrow for me compared to the fundamental study of the fact of being human. So I sort of dropped out and went traveling and went to the East with the idea of getting away from the familiarity that I'd grown out of, that which I'd grown up with. And when I got to India and wow, discovered there's meditation. There's this whole tradition of people who, like me, have become interested in consciousness. And then there's like a whole roadmap and a whole body of practices. There's all these tools for training the attention and exploring consciousness and going deeply into the matter of being human. And that was so wonderful to discover and so relieving in a way that I wasn't the only one who was torturing myself with these concerns. And it just became very quickly and strongly clear to me that, okay, wow, I'm going to spend my life doing this.
Wow. So you met Babaji, and what did you learn from him?
Oof. So I firstly sat... Well, I firstly just sort of bathed in the atmosphere of India a little bit and let that rock my world in a way and shake up the kind of assumptions and cultural norms with which I'd grown up, all of which were so different in India. And then I started to meditate and I did I took some courses with teachers in various places, mostly in Dharamsala, which was where the Tibetans were living in exile, still are living in exile. And then I met the kind of fortuitous way after a first meditation course, I decided, okay, I'm off to the cave, in a rather foolhardy kind of way, you know, and long story short, somebody directed me to this place where there was this hermit sadhu, living, and I ended up staying there about 2.5-3 years, on and off, coming and going, you know, some months. And then I go to Thailand and spend some months in a monastery and then back. But about 3 years I was with him. And the combination of the formal practice, which I was mostly getting from retreats in Buddhist monasteries, mm-hmm. and then the very informal context of just being with somebody who was very awake, very present, very... you know, who treated everything as if it was sacred. You know, whether it was making tea or gardening or tending the fire. And so there was something, Babaji didn't really teach me anything, but I learned a lot, you know, because it was sort of by osmosis. It was just the process of sitting quietly by the fire. Yeah. And then... So I guess what I learned in that sense, if I learned how to meditate in Buddhist monasteries, but I feel like I learned how to live it more with Babaji. And that sense of just integrating one's actions with a quality of care and attention, like, hey, everything every moment, every situation, every mind state, every person you meet, every difficulty you think you get into, every time you want to blame something, every time something goes wrong, everything is worthy of care and attention. Mm. That was really radical to me because I thought, you know, I'd made, no, there's this whole stuff that is worthy of care and attention, and it has to be deep, and it has to be special, and it has to be, and then there's this other junk, like my habits and all the stuff that I want to get away from and forget about, all the stuff I didn't want to give care and attention to. And ironically, of course, it's the stuff we least want to give care and attention to that's most in need of our care and attention, and actually that most will most yield to and be blessed by and resolve in the light of our care and attention.
Wow. Is that what you mean when you say most people are so half distracted that they haven't learned how to care for themselves?
When I say to get that which wants our care and attention, that's a lifelong learning, right? What does it mean to really give care and attention to something? Mm. And most especially to our own inner experience. You know, we can give care and attention in various ways. It's easy to give care and attention to somebody that we both love, right? Whether we're that's attracted to them or we just care for them easily. And when we can see that they need our attention. So sometimes our care and attention goes easily. But, for example, to our own heartache or confusion or restlessness or all the ways we can be hard on ourselves or dismissive of ourselves, there's so much that our care and attention doesn't easily go there at all. It bounces off. It gets distracted. We actively suppress feeling a lot of those things. And then even if we're not actively suppressing, we're often unconsciously avoiding. So there's a whole bunch of material, if you like, undigested emotional material, for example, that really is sort of crying out for our care and attention, and we don't even know it's there half the time. Mm. So embodied presence, to come back to the beginning, is a way of actually finding out what's here, what needs care and attention. And then learning how to give it care and attention, or if you put those together, how to give what's here caring attention.
Interesting. Tell me the story about painting the windows.
Yeah, so that's, in a way, that's a story about caring attention, right? And it's a story about this sense of a simple, gentle, every moment attention. So when I was staying with Babaji, looking for something to do, I noticed that the window frames around the two little huts of the ashram were peeling and could do with some paint. So I decided I would paint the windows, and became a project. And I wanted to do something, sincerely, I wanted something to contribute to the ashram. But on top of that, there was also another layer of wanting Babaji's approval and to do something impressive, and as is my, it was my tendency, before I've even gone to the shop, in my mind I've already got these lovely, brilliant windows, it becomes quickly an attempt to get from where I am. I've got to go and buy the paint, and I've got to sand the windows down, and then I've got to paint one base coat and then a top coat, etc. And I'm just wanting to get to that place called the finish line where the windows are all shiny and red, and where Babaji's all, "Oh, Martin, you've done a great job." So, I went off down to the town and bought the paint, etc. And I started work in that. I probably wouldn't have looked like I was rushing, but internally, that there was a sort of state, albeit a bit subtle, a sort of state of rushing, because I'm trying to sort of drive myself forward to this finish line, this ideal that I've got in mind of lovely, shiny painted windows. And Babaji said, no, stop. He said, "This is no good." He said, you're busy painting the windows. I said, well, yeah, you know, what do you expect? That's the job. He said, no. He said, God will paint the windows. He said, your job is just to take care of this brushstroke. Wow. So that's the essence, right, of embodied presence, right? To come back to just the feel of holding the brush. Oh, the noticing that my hand is more tense than it needs to be on the brush, unnecessary and unhelpful. So and then just to actually really watch the way the red paint, you know, lands on and colors the wood as the brush travels down it. And just to slow the whole process down. And it becomes sacred. It becomes unfamiliar. Yeah. It becomes alive. And then that vision of the nicely painted windows is gone. And I'm just there with the brushstroke, with the wood, with the sky above, with the sounds, with the smells of the moment.
Yeah.
And so it became a practice like that. And every time I would get ahead of myself, I'm just coming back to connecting, sensing, softening, etc. And what happened really at the end of whatever, a couple of weeks of that, I look back and it was really, really touching. I can still recall very vividly just that looking at the window and having that thought, wow, it's like God has painted the windows. And so rather than it being me trying to do something to impress my teacher, I somehow felt like I was a recipient of the blessing of those windows being painted. And rather than the hero of the story, you know. And I certainly was very busy trying to be the hero of my story. Mm-hmm. And that's exhausting. I think there's a line by Leonard Cohen, you know, when he says you stop trying to create the masterpiece and you let yourself just sink into the masterpiece.
Ah, there you go.
I have a friend who's a writer, and her little line of about writing is to go fearwards. That also has great parallels in meditation, right? We were just saying about giving care and attention to that which we don't want to give care and attention to. So it's not about going towards that which is, if something feels too painful or overwhelming, no, you can't work with that which is overwhelming. Then you need to give care and attention to something that isn't overwhelming. But increasingly we learn to actually touch into and make room for and allow the space to that which we have hitherto been afraid of, been pushing against, been distracting from. And so it's like going fearwards is what's healing. Go fearwards, go towards that which habitually right. You tend to ignore or deny or distract from.
Great. That's great. So tell me, what did you learn about creativity writing your book?
I sort of knew that the book was there, you know. I knew that I'd been teaching this material for a long time, so I knew it was there. But, you know, a first book is sort of a learning how to write in some way. So even though the structure was there, and actually the way I wrote then was I didn't, the first 6 months of the process, I did a lot of not writing the book. And a friend who I would check in with every now and then, we would laugh, you know, he'd say, so how's the book writing going? I say, oh yes, well, I tidied my office today and I chopped some wood and, you know, all the other things that are not writing the book. But I really see how that all that part of it really was part of the writing the book, because I was sort of digesting the material. It was kind of, I knew the rough structure, but I was just, digesting it, I would say, in a way that it's hard to describe. So that when I did then do the writing in two quite concentrated chunks, it was just there. And it actually wrote itself very easily then. One of those chunks, I was at home and I would write 2 or 3 hours a day in the morning. And then the second chunk, I was traveling. I was in Asia, mostly in India and in Bhutan. And I didn't have any dedicated time. I was had a whole group of Dharma students with me at those times. But because I was into the flow of the book and I knew what, if I had just half an hour here or there, I could just sit down for half an hour and plug right back in where I left off. And so I'd found then once that first period of not writing, but of really digesting and feeling my way into the material, meant that when I came to it, I didn't really take any wrong directions. I just wrote. And the book was hardly edited at all, actually, which was interesting. So I don't know what I can say I really learned about creativity. I guess if I learned anything, because I spoke to other friends who are writers, is that everybody has their own way, you know. And so some people do seem to need big chunks of time and no distraction, et cetera, et cetera. But even though that sounds like the classic way to write, it doesn't need to be like that. Mm-hmm. You know, J.K. Rowling famously wrote Harry Potter in snatched moments in a public cafe, you know, in the midst of, you know, very difficult material circumstances at the time. And I think that's just as common, actually, especially for people's early works are often written without time, without support, without knowing what they're doing. And but the wish and the kind of inner movement, knowing that one has something to say. If you don't have something to say, don't bother trying to write a book, really. There's enough books in the world. But if you really know you have something to say, even if you don't know how to say it, right, or you don't know the form, that bit doesn't matter. If you know you have something to say, then, you know, find a way to say it. And without the idea of what that ought to look like, whether it's just writing a short amount, that's another thing that some people do, right? They're just, okay, I'll commit. I'll write 250 words every day. And you don't have to worry about editing it or whether it's any good or not. And just establishing the habit of knowing you've got something to say and learning that you can say it. Mm-hmm. And then the filtering out of that can happen later. I tend to write a chunk one day, and then the next day when I come back, the first thing I do is read what I wrote yesterday and just tidy it up a little bit and then write a bit more. Mm-hmm. And then same thing, the next day I'll come back to that, tidy up what I wrote yesterday, and write a bit more. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk about, there's something in your book where you say poetry and art are driven by the sex drive. And I thought, okay, I have to ask you about that. What do you mean exactly? But I mean, remind me if there's William Yeats used to say that all writing or all good writing or good poetry is either about sex or death or both.
right.
But could you talk a little bit about that sex drive thing?
Yeah, I don't remember now writing that in the book. Oh. But I like it. I like
it. You were talking about the three drives, survival, sex, and social.
So the sex drive isn't necessarily all about sex, right? Sex is the most obvious expression. But let's look at those three drives, which are the main instinctual drivers within us for survival, for sex, and social. So the survival drive is like an inner loop, right? It's the self relating to the self. What do I need? How can I be safe? What's going to make me feel okay? Do I have enough food in the cupboards, etc.?
Yeah.
And for some people, that becomes primary. We've all got these drives, right? But they become psychological patterns within us so that it doesn't matter, even if you've got a stable place to live and plenty of food in the cupboards and enough clothing and etc., that doesn't assuage the survival drive, right? It just moves into other areas. So for some people can recognize that as their primary driver, the self's concern with the self. What do I need, etc., etc.? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then the social drive is more the sense of one's relationship to the world, right? Mm-hmm. The connection. And if for the people for whom that's their primary driver, the relationship with the world at large, what do they think of me? What's my status? How am I seen in the world? Mm-hmm. That's predominant, right? And so the loop there, rather than being self to self, you know, inner loop, it's more self to world. Mm-hmm. And then the sexual drive is self to other, but specific other, right? Mm-hmm. And so the sense there is, can you make me happy? You know, mm-hmm. What are you going to do for me? Are you the one? Mm-hmm. And so one's hoping with all of those drives, right, when they're just acting out emotionally, psychologically, one's hoping to get to a place of ease, safety, well-being, relaxation, etc. Mm-hmm. So the survival drive, if I can make myself feel comfortable enough and safe enough and secure enough, then I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. The social drive, it's like if I can really win the approval and love of everyone, then I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. And the sexual drive, it's right, if I can really just get you, if you and me can somehow completely blend, melt into each other, unite, then mm-hmm. I'll be okay. So I think probably what I was pointing to there is that sense of the way poetry, whether it's the kind of traditional, all the music, all the poetry that's been written about the love relationship, right? Mm-hmm. All the poetry of, hey, babe, I want you, you know, all those pop songs. Or whether it's the more mystical poetry, you read Hafiz or Rumi, where the lover is a cipher in a way for the divine. Or, you know, that's why what I love about Leonard Cohen is that the erotic and the mystical are completely entwined, right? And within there's so many of his songs and poems wherein each are referenced through the other. Mm-hmm. And so that sense of longing, there's something very beautiful. And often in Buddhist teachings, desire gets to be this sort of the enemy of the peace in a way. And I think it's unfortunate the way that desire gets presented as somehow a problematic force. Certainly we can get involved with desire in ways that are problematic, but desire in itself is just an intrinsic force. It's the force that drives those three very natural impulses. And to actually make room for the inevitable longing, the longing. And in the sexual drive, that longing is at its most sweet and its most painful often. But to let oneself really feel the longing, the wanting to unite with, the wanting to merge with, the wanting to dissolve into, the wanting to penetrate and or be penetrated by the other. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you follow that without getting hung up on the object, does he, she, they love me or not? Mm-hmm. If you just follow the movement, the longing, the longing, the longing. Longing itself can take you all the way to that uniting with and dissolving into. Huh. So I think we kind of need to reclaim. We've got these two unhelpful positions around desire. The worldly position is just pursue all your desires and try to meet them all, which is untenable, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's ever got to the end of desire that way.
Right.
Nobody's ever, now I've got just what everything and I can completely relax. No, actually satisfying desires just begets more desires and more desires. Mm-hmm. But you've got the equally untenable situation of a kind of religious uptightism or a religious kind of denialism, where there's the attempt to somehow stamp out desires or withdraw desire or cut off desire. So actually, I think an authentic spirituality, an embodied spirituality, it's riding along on desire, exploring desire, befriending desire. Mm. You know? And that's what I love about that word longing. For me, longing is that quality of desire where one's willing to kind of really let the heart be touched by it. You know, willing to let in the beauty of, longing for the beloved, longing for depth, longing for unity, longing to be so intimate with life that I can be subsumed by it. Exquisite.
Mm. There are two things I wanted to talk at the end of this. So the one is the thing you talk about, this sort of insight you had when you were in India watching people being cremated by the river, by the Ganges, I presume, and that you had this kind of insight about death that I'd like you to talk about.
Yeah.
Because it's related to creativity. So
Okay. I mean, it's sort of ordinary in a way. The experience I'm thinking of right now was actually in Nepal and Kathmandu, out at Swayambhunath, where the cremation ghats there. And I spent quite a lot of time sitting at the ghats in India and watching the bodies burn. And that's a very kind of recommended practice in the tradition. I need to reflect on, well, that's going to happen to me someday. That's what happens to everyone. And we don't need to go to cremation ghats for that. You can do that with roadkill. You know, you see an animal that's been killed, and then you drive next day, it's a bit flatter, and then it's eventually it's a dry stain, and then it's just gone. But this particular time, I was walking across the ghats and up into the hills in the morning, and in India and Nepal, bodies are cremated very quickly after death. And so somebody had died. I can't remember now the details, but the family had come, and you know, the family are in the middle of their paroxysms, in some cases, of grief. And they're also organizing the business of the funeral, and the pyre is lit, and the clothing starts to burn on the body. They're not burned in boxes or in coffins, right, but just lying visibly on the funeral pyre. And I stayed and watched for a while at a distance because I wanted to be respectful to the family. And then I continued my walk up into the hills for a few hours. And when I came down, that same cremation was just coming to an end. And the relatives were sitting nearby, drinking tea, talking among themselves rather quietly. And the doms, the people who manage the cremation ghats, were just finishing up. And there was just a pile of ashes, and they were sweeping the ghat to make ready for the next cremation and sweeping the last few ashes into the river. And I just watched a few minutes as the very last few swishes of the broom, the last dust went into the water and floated downstream, and there's just nothing there. Mm-hmm. Just sitting there, that profound mystery of nothing left. Mm-hmm. Nothing left. And then one, you know, compares to here I am, like I feel so alive. And actually that's important, to let in how alive I feel. And the total mystery of I cannot say where this aliveness came from. I can tell you the story about my birth, etc., but it actually feels beginningless, this aliveness. I can't tell you where the center of it is. I can't find where the edges of it are. And I can't tell you where it will go at death. And to really sit in the mystery of that, wow, to feel one's aliveness, to enter into one's aliveness, not with a story, not with an explanation, not with any understanding, just with the kind of letting oneself be subsumed by the sheer vitality and mystery and immediacy of life. Mm-hmm. And just to sit there in that and then look at this empty space on the ghat. And I sat there for an hour or so. And then, of course, they start to build the pyre for the next funeral that will come along. And the world's moved on. And another dead body is about to arrive. And so, like I said, we're not very good often culturally at really bringing death into the conversation, into the public discourse, into our own hearts. And in a lot of traditional cultures, the death isn't so hidden away. There isn't so much denial of or fear around death. And I found that very, very refreshing.
Hmm. Well, it brings to mind for me that idea of contemplating on death, bringing about this kind of knowingness about your aliveness, you know, and creativity comes out of that aliveness.
Yeah.
An expression of that aliveness. So that's what I thought of when I read your book. Mm. The other thing I wanted to talk about is there's a poster that you read about, or something that you put, that somebody put on a refrigerator, some quote from you about freedom of being is the absence of anxiety about imperfection, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, let's talk a little bit about this freedom of being thing, because that's at the heart of it. And it's what I really like about your teachings. And you talk about the three ways to get to that.
And my God, that sounds good. I don't know that. Three ways to freedom of being.
I'll read them to you. The three shifts that have to happen for you to be liberated, to find a liberated life. One is the shift from the body as object to the body as experience. And we've talked about that.
Yeah.
And then the second one is shift from the ownership of experience to letting go of and let life happen, like let things happen. And we've talked a little bit about that. And the third is the shift beyond the individual to the collective.
That links back a little bit to what we were saying earlier about letting the world come to you, right, Michael? Actually, we're most of us, we're sort of pathologically self-centric. We just so caught up in me, I, and me, and my, what I want, what I need, what I like, what I think. Mm-hmm. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, it's just not that important. You know, it's not completely unimportant. It's not, I'm not suggesting we become self-forgetting and we stop taking a shower in the morning or feeding ourselves well, right? But that we realize, wow, we take ourselves so bloody personally, you know? It's just, that's where our angst and our outrage and our intolerance of others comes from. Like the fact that what I think is so important, what I want is so important, what I believe is so important. I mean, you see that in the political polarity playing out, right? Because we're so busy trying to be right and then making the others wrong.
Yeah.
So it's the encouragement to recognize, it's not about taking a view, oh no, I wonder, I've got to listen more to others, etc. But to realize that, I mean, even in the act, like right now, again, let me make it real. You're sitting here listening, and then your eyes are seeing, right? We want it, well, the tendency is to take ownership of that. I'm hearing, I'm listening, I'm choosing. I could press stop, you know, I'm looking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, but that gives you the primary place, right? It's what I'm seeing and what I'm listening to. But there's the other side of that listening, right? There's the fact that listening is happening. Listening is this extraordinary interplay between the organ, right, of subjectivity, which we call me, and that which is being listened to, which we call the object, the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, this attunement that we're speaking about, right? So we take the I, me, and my, we make it less central by actually, you know, listening, letting the listening itself be more important than the one who's doing the listening. And that's the same, you know, when you walk down the street. You know, I live in the countryside generally, right? So I'm walking among trees, but I'm in Paris at the moment. And then the city is different. City is reflected to reinforce I, me, and my. You know, all those advertising billboards, what do you want? You know, you need this to be successful and to be happy and to be attractive, etc. Mm-hmm. So, okay, we understand why. It's not to demonize the city. But what about if you actually make a practice out of not just looking in every shop window as a narcissistic feedback loop to what do I want and what do I need or what don't I have? But you actually, you know, you attune to the fact that all these beings sharing a street, you know, we walk opposite each other and we make room for each other. And to see the commerce that's happening in stores as a kind of exchange. Wow, it's a miracle, amazing. I go into a store and I take what I need and I offer the money and that supports the person's well-being and they give me what I need and that supports me and I leave the store. Mm-hmm. One can engage in that in a very self-centric way or one can just open the attention and to a sense of mutuality. So when actually there's just a different kind of respect and appreciation for others, who care, regardless of their political ideals, right, in that moment. And then the way one walks on the street, to see that as a collective, you know, like when you look down and you see a bunch of ants and the ants have got this sort of self-organization thing. Or if you've got an Apple TV and they show their zoomed out photos, right, of traffic or something. And it's
right,
like,
it's
all orchestrated almost, it looks like. And so it's like letting yourself be part of life's orchestration. It's like finding your place in the whole, like resting the I, me, and my into the whole, because the whole is what's happening. Much, you know, more primarily and more important than what's happening with me, what's happening here and what's happening right here, right now, is always much bigger than me. So coming to your senses, taking in the seeing and the hearing and the feeling and the walking is a way of putting down one's self-importance, one's self-centricity.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. That's terrific. Well, thank you, Martin, for your time and for your book.
Thank you for joining us today. If you're interested in finding out more about Martin's book, you can go to his website, martinaylward.com. That's Aylward, AYLWARD. Until next time, stay safe and be well.